Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Abe Sauer, a previously unknown journalist who's been writing great stuff from Wisconsin for a great website, The All. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Steve Early, the veteran labor journalist, who's just out with a book on the internal combustion of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, once led by its former president and golden boy, Andy Stern. Before that, some words in the news. I don't have much to say about the headlines, except to say that what's been going on in Japan is utterly heartbreaking, and anyone who advocates for more nuclear power plants now, and there's still plenty of those, so they've largely kept their mouths shut over the last week, they should have their heads examined. How many more crises and disasters do we need to force the realization that finding clean, renewable forms of energy may be the most urgent task facing civilization today? But crises don't foster reason. One of my beefs with the peak oilers, aside from the empirical one in which I suspect that they're just wrong about hydrocarbon production, is that impending scarcity doesn't make people more amenable to rational argument. It inclines them to desperate measures. Polls show more Americans now support offshore drilling and opening up the Alaska wilderness to oil exploration than have in a long time. The BP spill had no lasting effect on public opinion. Gas over $3 a gallon has a far more potent influence on public opinion than is a fading memory of dead fish far away. I know the effects of the BP spill have been far worse than that, but I think that's how people dismiss it in memory. In the words of the wonderful poet A.R. Emmons, who wouldn't turn up the voltage when you know the lights are going out? Speaking of crisis, as this show airs, I'll be emceeing a panel at the Left Forum in New York City, along with KPFA's Sasha Lilly and some other names familiar to a Bay Area audience, on the political dangers of catastrophism. Here's a version of my introduction. The economic crisis has caused a lot of juices to run the political left. For the last couple of years, as it looked like both the financial system and the real economy were in meltdown, a curious word given the news from Japan, a certain subset of radicals have been very excited. For years, many of them hoped for some sort of bone-crunching crisis, some rerun of the 1930s that might have fortunate political effects. The mechanisms of that imagined fortunate transformation are rarely specified, but presumably they involve some sort of productive disillusionment. The masses, once duped by a plenitude of consumer goods supplemented with a lot of snazzy ideology produced by the consciousness industry, would finally come to their senses once that narcotic flow was interrupted. Presumably, that coming to sense would involve an embrace of some sort of anti-capitalist agenda and not some desperate longing to return to the status quo ante. Given the absence of any widespread radical critique or organization going into the crisis, it's not clear how those would suddenly materialize in the midst of one, but no matter. This is a story of some magical intervention, a deus ex machina that would do the work that all our efforts at agitation to date have yet to accomplish. Of course, these good things have not happened yet in this crisis, neither here nor anywhere else. That's not surprising, since the historical evidence mostly shows that crises are good for the right, not the left. Crises make people want to retreat to the familiar, not strike out in new directions. So here and in many other places around the world, we're seeing an upsurge in nativism and xenophobia, not solidarity. The 1930s were an exception, but that's because things got really, really awful then, with the unemployment rate maxing out at 25%. Times have been bad here lately, but nothing like that. Do we really want to see the unemployment rate more than double because it might be good for politics? Okay, events in Wisconsin are encouraging, though recall that they're in reaction to the ascendancy of a very right-wing governor. I do hope that this upsurge continues and spreads, but there's a risk that it will get siphoned off into support for Democrats who, if they find their way back into power, will just do watered-down versions of the Governor Walker agenda. And now we're seeing pronouncements from some very smart people who are saying that the economy will never recover. Maybe it won't. I presume, against all recent evidence, that capitalism isn't an eternal social formation. But you've got to hand it to the thing. It's been remarkably inventive over the centuries. To read some of the gloomsters, you'd think that capitalism hasn't been able to generate any growth for the 7 or 8 centuries of its existence. I think it's a very unwise move to bet against its resilience. We need a critique of capitalism that works when the thing is doing reasonably well, which it does much of the time. Because when it's doing well, it's still appalling, unstable, destructive, alienating, polarizing, and violent. If you can't devise an indictment of capitalism when things are going well, meaning that there are no visible threats to its reproduction from day to day, then you might as well give up, because it's going to outwit you. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Wisconsin.
We'll be right back.
was some of P.J. Harvey's This Glorious Land from her new album, Let England Shake. My first guest is Abe Sauer. Abe came out of nowhere a while back, writing good stuff out of the Midwest for the excellent website The All. That's theawl.com. He's been living in Wisconsin, and his reports on the political turmoil in that state over the last few weeks have been splendid. Abe Sauer. Welcome, Abe. So is Wisconsin returning to some semblance of normal or not?
I would say that Wisconsin never left a semblance of normal. The huge crowds aren't gathered at the Capitol on a daily basis anymore. But there wasn't really that much that was changed about Wisconsin from a aesthetic standpoint. It was very, it's a philosophical battle over where Wisconsin's going in the future. So I think that if there is something that is out of whack and out of normal, it is something that people carry with them on a daily basis and not so much something you can see outside of a few signs around the Capitol.
Yeah, I used to know a performance artist in New York who had a routine that was based around the line, Wisconsin can be weird. Is that the normal in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think that Wisconsin can be very, very normal and very, very weird at the same time. It's often credited with serial killers and everything else, but that's kind of one of the it has a very big swing of populace from farmers who are, kind of very throwback people of the earth sort of people, and real cutting-edge social politics of Madison and in some instances Milwaukee and places like Milwaukee with a very large urban population that is facing all the challenges and kind of the push forward that urban populations have brought to the United States for centuries. Whether it be labor rights born out of, the horrible working conditions in large city factories. So Wisconsin has a little bit of a weirdness in that respect. It's just such a well-matched population that a lot of what you will find in America as a whole is going on there. So to say Wisconsin is a weird place is really just to say that America is a weird place.
That's a non-controversial point, I would say. Did people expect what Walker turned out to be? I just read something that claimed that about 40% of the public workers voted for Walker. Was he a surprise when he came in with this insanely radical agenda?
There are some who expected what he came in with. I would say that his financial backers expected what he came in with. A lot of the people who voted for him did not expect anything this radical. Part of that is that the coverage of the election in the run-up to November was pretty standard along, here's your Republican and here's your Democrat, who was Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee. You hear so much about the two cohort teams in American politics that you kind of just expect what, the kind of bumper sticker of that team is, and you vote for it. Walker was very, very opposed to abortion, and that, plays very well with a lot of Wisconsin residents who would probably vote for him again solely for that reason. And, the Democrats wanted they wanted Barrett for a whole number of social reasons also. I don't think that there was a lot of investigation into the details of what Walker would do in any kind of fiscal plan. He definitely talked about the desire to privatize things and his belief that private free market industry will do a better job than government. That's never been a secret. There has been some talk about how his union-busting measures were never a secret, but as far as I can tell, nobody has been able to uncover exactly where he laid that out in detail. After he was elected, even, there were a lot of complaints that he was very stingy with any kind of details about his 250,000 job creation plan. And he really had very little challenge on that campaign promise when he was saying, I mean, it sounds great. I'm going to bring 250,000 jobs to Wisconsin. But he didn't seem to have any detailed plan for that, as most politicians don't have a detailed plan, usually because it involves, you know, creating those jobs on backs of somebody else who will pay for it. So I think that his financial backers weren't really looked into very tightly. It just wasn't a big issue for the campaign on a daily basis. So I think that, to answer your question simply, yeah, a lot of people were very shocked when he came out with this kind of extreme overreach, which was more about setting up Wisconsin for years to come instead of just balancing his budget.
And going into the election, was there a sense that Wisconsin was in an economic or fiscal crisis? The Wisconsin economy has been doing relatively well compared to the rest of the country. The unemployment rate is lower. Was this sense of emergency palpable in November, or was it a post-November discovery?
No, I mean, every state has been in this sense of emergency since, you know, 2008. That was no different in Wisconsin. Everybody knew that there was going to be a very large budget shortfall, and that it would have to be made up somehow, either by raising taxes or by, you know, cutting services or in some other way. It was definitely a major element to the campaign. It was a subject that most Wisconsinites knew well about. I would say that Wisconsin is a place where this is, you know, since Tommy Thompson's era, who was governor for many years through the 90s, every biennial budget has been a debate about how Wisconsin's broke and how we have a giant fiscal shortfall and Chicken Little, and everybody's got to, you know, and it's going to be a huge problem, and it's going to destroy the state. That's kind of always been the problem. Property taxes are very high in Wisconsin. I mean, they're not the highest, but they're high. And, you know, instead of a lot of the other fees and kind of nitpicky taxes that aren't called taxes of other states, Wisconsin just calls them taxes and nails you with high property taxes. And so that has always been a big concern, that people think that they're going to get a balanced budget that is going to come purely from gouging the taxpayer. So it's always been, 2008 was, you know, until the 2010 election, was a very, I would say, extreme case of everybody being concerned about fiscal matters in Wisconsin. But it's really something that kind of comes up every election in Wisconsin. And to some degree, they do kick the can down the road when it comes to balanced budgets. But they've always been able to balance a budget here. Wisconsin has never been all that bad. The Pew Center puts the funded pension liabilities in the state, in one of the only four states in America that is funded up to 95%. So it's really it's been a very well-managed state for the most part by comparison.
So do you buy the argument that a lot of the Walker's agenda is political, to cripple the Democrats as a political force in Wisconsin, but if emulated around the country?
Well, definitely it's a major advantage to cripple the biggest, you know, kind of fundraiser of your competitors. I think that, you know, is a very good side benefit. And I think that people like Rance Priebus, who came out of Wisconsin and is now the head of the GOP for America, I think that this is something that would be a very strategic idea that, you know, the Republicans would like to see happen. And whether or not that would translate nationwide, I mean, clearly there are a lot of bills that suddenly came up with this provision in them nationwide. And that doesn't just happen organically. You know, there are a lot of think tanks that see these kinds of things and you know, in some cases, flat out write the legislation. I would say, though, that a bigger advantage to busting the union in Wisconsin, and he didn't bust all the unions, you know. He left the fire department and the police aside, partly to create an inner union battle there itself, but also because he really wanted to bust the unions that would stand in the way to privatizing Wisconsin services. and that's the teachers union and other state workers unions. Now you can, without them in the way, it's much easier to take services provided by the state and switch them to private enterprise, and then they can become profitable. Some of that is seen in the bill already with the power plant provision to sell those off.
Wisconsin has some municipal power supply companies?
Yeah, so there's like 30-some state-owned power plant facilities, heating and cooling centers and stuff, that the bill makes room to be sold off at no-bid contracts. So basically, you know, if you were a private enterprise and you wanted to, you know, basically buy something that has a built-in base of payments coming back to you, it would be very good to buy a power plant. Now, if that power plant is extremely expensive, I mean, the selling of power plants to private industry is in and of itself not it's not automatically a bad thing, as long as what the state gets for that power plant is true value for what it would get in revenues through the future. But if it's a no-bid contract that, you know, is sold off on the cheap so that the private industry now has this built-in income stream, and that income stream happens to be the state itself because those power plants service things like prisons and whatnot, you're basically selling payments from the taxpayers to a private business for the future for a rate that, if it's a no-bid, probably is below market value. And that's not a true free market system, as, you know, Walker and his supporters claim to be champions of. That's robbery, actually.
I'm speaking with Abe Sauer, who has been writing about Wisconsin for The All. And you, in a piece that appeared on Wednesday or Thursday, dealt with some arguments that what Walker did is very much what like Obama did with health care reform, just forcing this thing through. And what was your reaction to that claim?
Well, the comparison was more about how people are perceiving these two things. And, you know, a fairly common comment I've run into from Walker supporters and to some degree other Republicans in looking into the whole Wisconsin debate right now is that it's kind of a, you know, now you know how we feel after health care reform. And, you know, even though the two bills are wildly different and you know, even aim to accomplish different things, and you can't really compare them on what's in the bill alone. The way that people perceive that they've been, quote-unquote, forced down their throats, the way that kind of we're in the dark about a lot of it, and that's just a perception. In that sense, they are very much the same. You know, both were passed with this kind of stamp of elections have consequences, which isn't really about legislating at all. It's about, you know, sticking your foot in the butt of the other guy because, you know, revenge is sweet. And that's kind of the comparison. The other part of the comparison that is actually true of both bills is that they don't really solve the problems that they've set out to do. You know, healthcare reform will improve healthcare. Walker's budget bill will balance the budget. But the biggest thing that they have in common is that both of them are just giant payoffs to private enterprise, to very big private enterprise that you know, supported either whether it was Rahm Emanuel's kind of tinkering to make the Democrats into the, you know, now largest recipients of healthcare largesse, to Walker's kind of partnership with a lot of the private enterprises and anti-tax corporate policy think tanks and things like that. But they both end up costing the American people more and seeing their money flow into huge corporate enterprises. There may be some good that they get out of it, but that isn't how the bills got passed. And that is how they are really very similar.
I hope, looking forward, Walker's bill passed. and it looks like he's going to get what he wanted. What's next? I mean, what are the forces who had been occupying the capital up to now? How are they changing their strategy?
Well, there's definitely a very large recall effort going on. I believe there's 14 senators on both Democrats and Republicans for whom papers have been filed to recall them. Some of those efforts are very good spiritually, but they're not going to probably end up with either a recall election or the senators getting recalled. The polling results that I've seen say that there's probably 3 Republican senators total of all 14 recall potentials who may face some kind of a risk. So that remains to be seen. They have 60 days to get all the signatures. So there's definitely the recall effort. Walker still is going to have, you know, for the most part, a Republican majority, and he is probably, you know, he won with a 52% vote, so next time around, he knows he's not going to get reelected. I would look for him to just ram through everything that he can, especially in the next, I would say, 10 to 12 months. One of those things I've already kind of written about a little bit is a voter ID bill, which, you know, Wisconsin has a minimum problem with voter fraud. I think they've prosecuted like 20 cases in the last 3 years or something like that. And most of those are convicts who voted and didn't know they couldn't vote. It isn't the kind of fraud that everybody talks about. But that bill will disenfranchise old people, students, since student IDs won't be allowed. And a large number of other people, especially, you know, Milwaukee's urban residents, and they, that is a way that they're kind of going to make sure elections don't have consequences in the future. The voter ID bill is probably worse than union busting in a lot of ways, because it is complete disenfranchisement from America's promise of democracy. And Wisconsin has one of the highest voting rates of any state. And the saddest thing is that a voter ID bill like this, which is going to pass, it's already on the table, it'll probably pass in April. The worst part of this is that it just is going to affect people on both sides. The Republicans don't even seem to care that they're going to disenfranchise a lot of their own voters, as long as they're disenfranchising even more of the other side's voters. It's being ramrodded through with this idea that voting fraud is a huge problem. And in Wisconsin, there's not a single statistic. I don't care what John Fund over at the Wall Street Journal claims that he has. It's just not true. There are plenty of stats to show that there is just not that problem in Wisconsin. But they're going to do that. Then there's, you know, a whole, you know, they'll look for other areas that they can increase the private, with these private-public partnerships. The Department of Commerce was switched from just a straight State Department of Commerce to something called the Department of Commerce Corporation, which is now part private, part public. So what I would look for Walker to do is continue to try to create these 250,000 jobs that he has promised in 2 years, to actually bring those jobs from state employees and switch them to private enterprise, and then call them created jobs. And that, you know, that's kind of an accounting trick where he'll be able to say, I created 20,000 jobs, but it will have been by eliminating the State Department and turning it over to private enterprise.
Well, it looks like Walker's also created a large movement of opposition, not just in Wisconsin, but it seems to, the spirit seems to be spreading around the country. Do you think that has legs, or is this going to flame out as he scores legislative victories?
No, I definitely, you know, the pendulum will swing the other way in some respects. He has energized a lot of people who weren't energized before politically, especially a lot of young people. I think he's made a bit of an overreach mistake here, where he's messing with teachers, and he's made them the targets of kind of all that's wrong with America. And this isn't just Walker. There's a whole bunch of groups behind this idea. But, you know, now where you see where, you know, people are openly complaining about how teachers are overpaid, and they're just like, they have it easy and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, all those people, it's kind of like, you know, messing with the babysitter. And then, you know, when you leave the house, expecting that she isn't going to tell your kids that you're a huge jerk. You know, teachers have the face time with young kids, whether it's college or high school or whatever. So I think that in some respects that will happen. I saw myself hundreds of Madison High School kids who walked 2 miles from the high school to the Capitol be part of this. They're not going to forget that. They may not be the most politically energized people in the next few years, but, you know, they will remember this quite well. And in other states, you're seeing a little more activation, and people may start to look more closely at some of this legislation. And, you know, one of the biggest things is the Koch brothers who came into this. You know, every story and every big fight needs, like, a single evil person. You know, whether it was Nixon, you know, there's a lot of players with a lot of names, but people need, like, one bad guy, one Darth Vader kind of figure. And the Koch brothers, who were joined by many other people in this, they've become, like, a good single evil figure to have for a movement. And as long as the movement is focused on something like that, it can stay energized. I think it will peter out a little bit, but I think we'll have to see in Wisconsin on April 5th, there's some elections for mayor and Supreme Court, and that will go a long way to telling us exactly how energized this population is.
All right. Thanks, Abe. That was Abe Sauer, who's been writing about Wisconsin for the excellent website, The All, theawl.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Steve Early. Some of Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who. I play that mainly because I quote that line, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, in the following interview. Steve Early is a veteran labor journalist. His new book on the struggles in and around the Service Employees International Union and its former president, Andy Stern, is just out from Haymarket Books. It's called The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor, Birth of a New Workers' Movement or Death Throes of the Old. I'm not sure he answers the question of the subtitle, but it's a fine book about an important matter. Steve Early. Welcome, Steve. You open the book with a description of a remarkable SEIU convention in Puerto Rico in 2008 with armed guards and everything. What was that all about? Why was it an armed camp looking like the, as you put it, the WTO?
Well, in the summer of 2008, the service employees were not just holding their convention in San Juan, they were gearing up for a representation election in which they were going to be the only choice on the ballot in a unit of 40,000 public school teachers in Puerto Rico. The only problem with that scenario is that the Puerto Rican teachers already had a union, a militant democratic union called the FMPR, that had waged a 10-day strike 3 years ago and then had been certified by the Puerto Rican government as punishment for striking illegally against school privatization and over other issues. SEIU represents both school principals and supervisors and support staff and was uniquely positioned as a North American union to provide solidarity and support for this very important independent union struggle in Puerto Rico. Instead of doing that, Dennis Rivera, a leader of SEIU from Puerto Rico originally, and Andy Stern essentially cut a deal with the then governor to charter a new union to represent the teachers, a union affiliated with SEIU, and attempted to replace them. And when that vote was finally held in the fall of 2008, the teachers resoundingly rejected the SEIU takeover attempt, though to this day they have yet to regain their bargaining rights and are still struggling to do that.
And so this was obviously rather controversial, and so they turned the convention center into an armed camp.
They did. The governor who had tried to destroy their union was then under indictment on political corruption charges. He was later acquitted, but at the time, President Obama wouldn't go near him, but SEIU welcomed Governor Acevedo Villa to speak at the convention, essentially applauding a union-busting boss, someone who had just tried to destroy the largest public sector union on the island, not exactly exemplary behavior by one of the largest public employee unions in North America. So there were protests. There was incredibly tight security. At one point, the teachers bravely broke through the police line, set up a picket line right outside the convention center. And at that point, the Puerto Rican riot squad was called out to protect the delegates and prevent them from fraternizing in any way with the Puerto Rican teachers, many of whom were female and, you know, weighed about 90 pounds soaking wet, hardly a threat to public order and security in San Juan.
What was SEIU's interest in these Puerto Rican teachers? Is it, did they have some kind of ideological affinity with union busting, or are they just interested in expanding their numbers and their dues income?
What was motivating them?
I mean, it was a purely opportunistic foray. Again, in the U.S., though inconsistently, SEIU has been a foe of privatization when it would undermine its own members' collective bargaining rights and job security. In Puerto Rico, it attempted to undermine a union that was the leading foe of school privatization. SEIU doesn't represent education workers in North America. It clearly just wanted to grow. And the book, Civil Wars in U.S. Labor, really is a saga of what happens when a union becomes totally obsessed with growth uber alles and essentially becomes like a Ponzi scheme, grabbing new members any way it can from other unions until the whole scheme crashes, which it has in a sense in SEIU.
Yeah, let's go back and talk about that strategy of density. I mean, it seemed like Andy Stern, who is longtime president of the union, believed that once the labor movement achieved some magic level of density, everything would change, and therefore growth was really the number one imperative. How did they go about adding their numbers?
Well, I want to make it clear, as somebody who was a union organizer for nearly 30 years and tried to help another union, the Communication Workers of America, grow in both the private and public sector, I'm very pro-organizing and very appreciative of some of the innovative strategies that SEIU did develop, for example, to organize publicly funded home-based workers who provide child care and home health care aid services in many different states. That workforce was, in fact, one of the largest sources of its membership growth over the last 10 years, 400,000 or 500,000 new members. And many of these workers, women, minorities, immigrants, taking care of children, the chronically ill, senior citizens trying to live at home, were paid very poorly. Many of them were still in workfare programs, and all were treated as independent contractors. And what SEIU did was pioneer the strategy of working political deals with labor-friendly legislatures or governors, creating new bargaining units at the bottom tier of the public sector where these workers could win bargaining rights and begin to negotiate some job protections and pay improvements and some minimal benefit coverage. That's actually a strategy that three or four other unions, including my old union, the Communication Workers, copied in certain states. And it's one that's unraveling some now under the bipartisan assault on collective bargaining throughout the Midwest. One of the first things that Governor Kasich did in Ohio, for example, was by the stroke of a pen abolish two bargaining units, one represented by the service employees, one by the state, county, municipal employees, home-based workers. And Governor Walker's legislation has also wiped out a newly created unit of home health care aides in Wisconsin. So these folks were vulnerable before. They're still very vulnerable. And their loss of bargaining rights is particularly grievous because they never had traditional public employee pensions or health coverage or decent pay.
But what about the rest of the strategy?
Well, the other strategy that SEIU pursued that became more controversial was essentially trying to partner with employers in return for the employers agreeing not to interfere with union organizing efforts. As you know, in the private sector, whether it's in healthcare or telecom or manufacturing, most non-union employers vigorously, aggressively resist unionization efforts. They spend huge amounts of money on lawyers, they fire workers, they harass, intimidate, they do everything they can to avoid the majority of their employees gaining union recognition and trying to negotiate contracts. What SEIU tried to do, particularly dealing with nursing homes, with certain hospital chains, with certain food service companies and security firms, was try to offer some mix of carrots and sticks to neutralize those anti-union campaigns, which on paper is a good strategy. A lot of other unions have pursued it. The problem is if you go too far in the direction of offering the carrots rather than using the stick to improve employer behavior, you end up winning bargaining rights, gaining new members, but the workers themselves have very weak contracts, very few job rights, little connection to the union, and the employer is getting the benefit of union lobbying and other forms of assistance without any real new unions being built.
You say that as kind of a possibility, but how did things turn out for the SEIU workers who were organized under these circumstances?
Well, over time, this strategy became controversial, particularly in California, where the third largest SEIU affiliate, United Healthcare Workers Brass, UHW, beginning in 2007 and more so in 2008, began to criticize the trade-offs that the national union leadership was insisting were necessary to gain new members. They argued that these organizing rights deals were undermining contract standards in the nursing home industry, that they were endangering the ability of existing members in hospitals in California to improve their pension and benefit coverage. UHW was a very active organizing union, but it was one that felt you had to grow based on a mobilized and well-represented base of existing members. This led to conflict over the direction of the union with the national union leadership, and ultimately the national union, under Stern, stepping in and seizing control of this model local 2 years ago.
And what then happened when they seized control?
Well, it was a terrible squandering of union resources. Millions of dollars were spent physically occupying the various UHW offices around the state. More than 100 elected leaders were removed from the union. Thousands of stewards who refused to sign a loyalty oath to the new appointed leaders of their local were removed. The forces within UHW who had tried to reform SEIU were at that point forced to pursue a different strategy of creating an independent union, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, which over the last several years since then has been competing with SEIU for bargaining rights in, among home care workers in nursing homes and hospitals in California, and also doing some organizing of the unorganized, and now represents about 8,000 California healthcare workers.
I'm speaking with Steve Early, a longtime labor journalist and author of the book Civil Wars in U.S. Labor, which is just out from Haymarket. This was not the only civil war you refer to in the title of the book. Give us some idea of the other wars that Stern was fighting with his comrades in the labor movement.
Well, before the inter-union conflict with the Puerto Rican teachers and the intra-union dispute with UHW members in California, SEIU had been waging a very costly multi-year war with the California Nurses Association, which is now part of a larger network of nurse organizations called National Nurses United. SEIU also ended up plunging into a very costly and disastrous conflict with a fellow Change to Win union, Unite Here, the merged garment and hotel workers union that had joined with SEIU to create a new labor federation in 2005. When the original merger partners, the garment workers and the hotel workers, began to consider a divorce. 5 or 6 years later, the CIU intervened in very messy fashion, hived off a group of about 70,000 members of this fellow Changed Wing union, triggering another whole front in civil warfare and food service and hotels and some casinos around the country. So clearly this growth strategy led to increasingly reckless and destructive and dysfunctional behavior, adversely affecting members of other unions, the CIU's own membership in California, and the unorganized workers who might otherwise have been organized if these progressive unions had not been so preoccupied with battling each other.
Stern also had a curious philosophy of unionism. It was that the union was not really a representative of the working class in its battle with capital, but in fact was supposed to partner with management to produce better enterprises. How'd that work out?
I would say not well. Stern has long had this idea that unions need to ingratiate themselves with employers by demonstrating ways that they can add value to the enterprise, which is a very strange conceptualization of the union role, because the union, if you think of it as an organization of workers, the workers themselves are creating the value, whatever it is, in the form of services or manufactured products. And the idea that their organization has to do something above and beyond that kind of leads any union away from playing the fundamental role of trying to provide some modicum of workplace justice and representation and advancing of the interests of workers, which often come into conflict with those of their employers. But Stern to this day, even now retired from his position as president of the union, continues to warn publicly about any reversion to class struggle unionism, any kind of adversarial approach to labor relations. He even was expressing in the Washington Post a few weeks ago the concern that these mass protests by public employees in Wisconsin might revive an old style of unionism that would be detrimental to the labor movement.
My sense of what management wants is they prefer no union at all to even the most friendly union. Who did Stern think he was talking to?
Well, he thought he could persuade employers that de facto company union, one that would not rock the boat, one that would really not represent workers effectively, aggressively, could be better than operating on a non-union basis. And there's a few sectors of the economy where that case can theoretically be made. I mean, healthcare institutions are enormously dependent on public funding, on Medicaid and Medicare. So when SEIU goes to the nursing home industry in California and says, we can be your lobbying partner, we can go to Sacramento and increase your Medicaid reimbursement rates, as they've done in New York State for the hospital industry there, for some employers that is a benefit worthy of changing their labor relations approach and perhaps cracking the door open a wee bit for unionization. The problem is it leads to kind of top-down deal-making and a total neglect of bottom-up real union building. And workers who come into unions as a result of deals and then have little say about their day-to-day job conditions, their contract isn't enforced, they have no role in negotiating future contracts, end up being pretty alienated and estranged and not easily mobilized for union causes.
Now, as all this controversy was coming to a head around Stern, the union launched a tremendous effort to find some friends among the intellectuals and academics who had been supporting them earlier and were now peeling away. Tell us a little bit about the ideological warfare that Stern funded and promoted.
Well, SEIU, to its credit, particularly under Stern, really invested a lot in the cultivation of relationships with students and intellectuals, both journalists and professors on campus, with filmmakers, with cultural organizations. A lot of unions are reluctant to relate to non-labor groups and individuals of this type. SEIU was very savvy about it, and as a result, in its heyday, was able to generate a lot of good publicity for itself, a lot of admiring books and articles, was able to utilize many friends on campus to help support very important low-wage worker organizing campaigns, including his various city-based Justice for Janitors campaigns. When these series of messy, disturbing, and destructive conflicts developed over the last several years, it created a kind of progressive quandary. A lot of the progressive non-labor allies of the service employees and the other unions involved were kind of put on the spot. They were asked to take sides. They were asked to chide the misbehavior of SEIU. And over time, many did that, but others refrained from doing so, in part because it would have endangered their substantial direct funding that they had received from SEIU for their various magazines and conferences and research institutes.
Talk a bit about the extent of that funding.
Well, SEIU has helped support United Students Against Sweatshops. It has helped support various worker centers around the country. It's a big funder of the Economic Policy Institute, an inside the Beltway think tank in Washington that issues very good reports about workers' rights and economic policy. It's been a contributor to the funding of various liberal and left publications. A lot of people who've been the beneficiaries of this kind of patronage are understandably reluctant to bite the hand that feeds them. There's not many other unions with the kind of deep pockets that SEIU has, and particularly folks in the field of labor education were vulnerable to the kind of pressure that SEIU applied to them to not speak out, to not criticize, or not even host forums in which some of the issues related to these civil conflicts within labor could even be debated and discussed.
So Stern is now gone, and he left behind a union in a lot of debt, right?
The cost of these interrelated conflicts that I describe in the book, I estimate to be about $140 million when you add up the expenditures on all sides, organizing costs, publicity, legal expenses. That's a huge amount of money to have squandered during the two-year period when we were told during Obama's first administration that we had a great opportunity to make gains in the area of health care reform, workers' rights, and a number of other legislative goals important to labor. SEIU spent heavily electing Obama and the Democrats in 2008. They spent heavily on politics last fall. And in the meantime, they put themselves deeply into hock due to the cost of this aggressive and dysfunctional behavior. So, yeah, the union is digging out of a financial hole and has had to raise the dues of its members in many places. And I think that's going to also lead to rank and file resentment and alienation and anger, because when people don't feel that they're properly represented and they're paying a lot of money for the union that they belong to, that can make them pretty unhappy.
And, of course, Stern has retired, and he's now succeeded by Mary Kay Henry. Is the new boss same as the old boss?
Yeah, but she's definitely presenting a kinder and gentler face. There's kind of a charm offensive going on where the leadership of SEIU now, which is essentially the ruling group around the now-departed Stern, who was president, and Anna Berger, who was secretary-treasurer, they're all part of the same team, but are projecting a different kind of image, are working more cooperatively with other Change to Win unions, the AFL-CIO, or acting in less arrogant and domineering fashion, and that's all winning them brownie points inside the Beltway. I think there's still a tremendous gulf between the needs and the interests and the hopes and aspirations of many SEIU members at the base and the headquarters, the top echelons of the union. And the biggest symbol of this disconnect, and it's more than a symbol, is the fact that SEIU, more than any other union, has shifted to a system of call center servicing of its members. Instead, as I describe in the book, of having a strong network of workplace stewards, co-workers, in the workplace every day who can help with job-related problems and questions and contract violations. When members in half of SEIU have such problems, they have an 800 number they call, and just like they're calling your insurance company or the phone company, they talk to a call center representative. And this experiment in call center servicing, as I explained in the book, has been a pretty costly and, I would say, disastrous failure.
Adolf Reed once said that Stern's vision of the labor movement is one giant human resource department. So is that living on?
Yeah, I mean, if you think that one of the major trends in human resources is outsourcing. In the film, in the book, actually, I invoke the film Up in the Air, where you had a Hollywood account of corporate outsourcing, where firms would hire a specialized HR outfit to go around and fire their workers for them. Well, and in the course of the film, they end up doing this from a call center rather than having people go out to workplaces and do it face-to-face. I mean, what SEIU has done internally is outsource a very important fundamental union function of providing face-to-face representation in the workplace and replacing it with the corporate model of kind of impersonal, over-the-phone, 800 number customer service. And union members are not supposed to be customers. They're supposed to be part of a workers' organization. And if they're going to build power, it has to be done in the workplace. And this network of call centers has become a very problematic way of providing union representation, but one that SEIU argued would enable them to devote more money to organizing and politics, so it hasn't worked out quite that way.
Now, the strategy of buddying up to employers and making deals with friendly politicians was supposed to, if nothing else, expand the ranks of organized labor. But we see union density figures released recently show continued decline in percentage of the workforce represented by unions. This strategy does not seem to be a promising one. So what would a better way be to reverse that long trajectory of decline?
Well, I think we need more independent political action. Unfortunately, SEIU pursued a very deformed version of that. They decided about 10 years ago that the best way to punish wayward Democrats who let down labor was to support more Republicans. And astoundingly, in the 2004-2005 election cycle, under Stern, SEIU contributed $500,000 to the Republican Governors Association, which helped back then to elect folks like Mitch Daniels, the current governor of Indiana, who, as soon as he got elected, basically stripped Indiana state workers of what limited bargaining rights they had, and then moved on to the public sector. And he's really provided a model for the current attack on public workers by Governor Walker in Wisconsin, Governor Kasich in Ohio. You would think SEIU would have learned from this, but no. In 2009-2010, they gave another $200,000 to the Republican Governors Association, Haley Barber proprietor. I can't think of a more self-destructive political strategy. I think what labor has to do, and it's difficult in our political system, is what unions and their allies have done in the great state of Vermont. They've developed over 30 or 35 years a capacity for independent political action. A third political party, the Progressive Party in Vermont, that actually has been able to elect a small group of members to the House and the Senate and the state legislature, elect a series of progressive mayors, the state's largest city, Burlington, and, of course, elect over 20 years repeatedly an independent socialist congressman and now Senator Bernie Sanders. One of the reasons you actually see a very serious push in Vermont this winter for state-level single-payer health plan that would go far beyond the national health care reform enacted last year is because you have a force, to the political force, well-organized to the left of the Democrats, that pulls them in the right direction. Where you don't have that, you have the drift towards the center and the right that we see with Obama and so many of the national Democrats.
And writing checks to Haley Barber is not going to do that.
It's certainly not. I think some of the millions that is spent, squandered really, on Democrats of dubious commitment to labor's cause might be better spent building independent political action vehicles, creating alternative institutions where labor could better convey its message to the broader public. This knee-jerk pumping of money into the coffers of the Democrats hasn't just triggered this, you know, retaliatory action by the Republicans in many states. It's just not served labor's purposes very well, since we see so many Democratic governors, from Cuomo in New York to the Val Patrick in my home state of Massachusetts, pursuing a kind of watered-down version of what Walker and Kasich are looking for, which is restriction of public employee bargaining rights.
That was Steve Early, whose book, The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor, Birth of a New Workers' Movement or Death Throes of the Old, is just out from Haymarket Books. I should say that Steve softened his message somewhat in the interview. He's tougher in the book, so you should all pick it up to see what I mean. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from that Brian Eno-John Cale collaboration I played another song from the other week. Till next week, bye. We have